All right, we are recording. I'm Jeremy Atkinson with Gopi Sandal. First question I'm going to ask you is, do you consent to have your oral history donated to the Religion in Kansas Project?
I do.
Hooray. Can you tell me your name and where you live and what you do for a living?
I am Gopi Sandal. I live at Bhaktivan Yoga Center near Baldwin, Kansas, and I teach yoga classes. I offer yoga teacher training, and I do a therapeutic massage.
And you are a Hare Krishna?
I guess you could say that.
Is that how you identify? What do you identify as a religious belief?
Well, I would say I'm a Vaishnava. And but yeah, most people just say Hare Krishna because that's our mantra. That's the main mantra that we chant, and that's the main kind of the most important part of the practice that we do is chanting this mantra.
What does a Vaishnava mean?
Vaishnava means a follower of Lord Vishnu or Krishna, and so it's a monotheistic tradition. It predates Hinduism, and it's considered to be like the very oldest spiritual tradition, Vaishnavism.
Okay. And where did you, where were you born? Where are you from originally?
From southeast Kansas. Grew up in a little town, and my dad was the local doctor, and my mom did nursing and helped him in the office, and I have four sisters, and so yeah, we grew up with a garden outside of town and had some horses, and it was very provincial kind of upbringing.
And what was your family's religious background when you were young?
They were going to the Methodist Church, and yeah, my mom was the MYF leader for many years, and Methodist Youth Fellowship, and so there would be, you know, campfires with the church, you know, kids groups, and I just remember that the nicest part about church was that when we would sing, everybody became really blissful. And I remember really appreciating that part. I never got the philosophy that much. I felt like there were some questions unanswered that I was curious about. But I really appreciated the feeling of being in church.
So when you were growing up, would you have said that you were a Christian, a believer, or would you have said you really didn't have a faith, you just kind of went along?
Yeah, I kind of went along. I really liked the idea of Jesus, and I would pray. But I there was a kind of openness probably about, you know, that probably set the stage for later when I, mm-hmm. you know, looked into other paths. I felt like this. I was just learning something, not so much different, but more information about the same, you know, curiosity that I had, the same thing that I was trying to figure out.
And how old were you when you started to look at other religious movements?
Probably when I was, you know, 17, 16, 17, I started, you know, asking about different traditions and checking into meditation of different kinds and reading books about different. And then when I got into college, you know, then I started really, really just wondering what was out there.
How did you come across Vaishnavism when you were in college?
I I met someone when I was traveling. My girlfriend and I planned a what we call the fool's journey when we were after I'd been in college for a couple years, and then when I was that was when I was 21, and so we decided that the night before we left for our journey to Europe together, we would do a theater piece at the art center. And this was called Who Is She? And so it was a kind of improvisational mime that we did about a generic girl who's looking for the meaning of life. And it was significant to me later because the story that we developed went something like this, that the stage opened on a kind of heavenly scene. There were people dressed in white robes who were kind of dancing around and tossing these invisible globes back and forth, playing with each other, and you could hear the sound of little finger cymbals being chimed, and they were chanting Om. So we didn't know too much about why we were doing what we were doing. We just had some kind of vague inspirations and ideas and went with it. And so then while they're playing in this heavenly environment, one of the people sees a bunch of masks that on sticks that were kind of like in a garden full of masks. And she picks one up and looks through it and sees the world of duality out there. And she starts saying, "Edges, fascinating." And somehow or other, this mask gets stuck on her face. And then there's a blackout. And she wakes up in a very mundane situation in a rocking chair, kind of trying to wake up from a sleepy state, saying, "Who, why, where, what, when?" And just then, there is a trickster appears with a mask of a coyote. So in Native American tradition, they have a coyote trickster. It's someone who comes, like God coming in many forms, to help wake you up. Mm-hmm. And so this trickster played those finger cymbals and tried to, you know, it was like she would almost remember, I seem to remember I came from someplace, but I'm like, she was just like totally, you know, in a forgetful state about where she came from. And so she starts this journey, you know, we mimed looking in our boots, behind the furniture, going outdoors, looking behind trees, searching everywhere, and didn't really know how to end this story, but then we did a, she starts saying, "I am, I am, Maya, 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 Maya," ends up chanting Maya, 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 which actually means the illusion of this material world. And anyways, so then the next morning we took off for Europe and had eventually we planned to go to a dance workshop in England. But for some time we were just going to roam. And so we got off the plane in Luxembourg and just walked and walked and walked in a huge, like, walked all afternoon without a map or anything and ended up coming right back to the place where we started. So, and this was just like hilarious to me because it was like an analogy of my life. I at that time was really feeling like full of this question that what is the meaning of my life? Where am I going and what is the why am I here? Where should I be going? What should I be doing? And so we hitchhiked and in Belgium we found this little church with an old monastery next to it. And in the church, it was very beautiful, had stained glass windows. And I remember sitting and praying to Jesus to please give me some guidance, give me some clues about why I was here. And then we stayed with a family that was living in this little monastery. We let us chop wood for room and board. And this woman, is it okay if I'm diverging?
No, this
diverging
is fine.
This much?
Is fine.
Okay.
This is what we want.
The lady of the house, who was, feeding us meals, she said to me, she was a little psychic, she said to my friend, "You will wear two braids, and you will be married soon." And she looked at me and said, "You will wear one braid, but you won't be married for a long time." And it was just after that, she helped, we tried to join the circus, and they wouldn't have us, and so we ended up, she got a ride for us to Paris and arranged for a place for us to stay. But I had this little book, which I had received in New York before on our way to England, a little book that a Krishna devotee had given us, with addresses, and there was an address in Paris, and so that's when I actually went to visit the temple. And when they gave us this book, they also gave us a record with George Harrison and some other people singing mantras on it. And I remember when I heard the sound of this mantra being sung, I felt very deeply that there's nothing more important for me than to find out what this means and to meet the people who are doing it. And I didn't think it would actually happen, but then when we were in Paris, that's what happened. I visited the temple and Krishna temple, and it was a very unique experience. It was a traditional temple. They had deities of Radha and Krishna there, and somebody explained to me that this is Krishna. This deity is a form of God, and for the very first time in my life, entertained the thought that, well, maybe God could be a person after all. I kind of gave up on that possibility before because it just didn't make sense. The old man in the sky idea didn't make sense to me. But they explained that actually God could have a form, a spiritual form, not a material form, but a form made of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, that he's an ever-youthful, extremely beautiful young boy. So I was intrigued with that. And then I went, we stayed there for a few days, and then they offered to let us visit the castle, the chateau out in the countryside in France. And I went there for a couple weeks, and it was very annoying. They kept saying things with so much assuredness and so much, you know, like, this is the absolute truth. This is, you know. And I found that very, very disturbing that they seemed to be so full of confidence about these things that I'd never heard before. But at the same time, I was, you know, like intrigued enough that I thought, well, I'm going to find out something more, because this information they were telling me about, they said, was from the oldest books in the world that their teacher had translated from Sanskrit. And so then I after a couple of weeks, my friend suggested that, you know, this is all very cool, but I think we should be moving on now. And just at that moment, this picture of Krishna like jumped off the wall right in front of us. I mean, there was...
Physically jumped out at you?
Physically, like, well, it fell off the wall and into our laps almost. And which there was like nobody running down the hallway or anything. It was kind of quite strange to us. And my friend turned to me and said, or if you want to stay, by all means, do what you want to do.
So you believe that was Krishna giving you a heads up?
I thought maybe that was a little hint. And but then we did go. We went on to London. Although as soon as I got to London, I was like, look, in the book, there's another ashram here. There's another temple here. We could visit it. And I went there, we went there, and I ended up staying there for 10 years. And my friend got married quite soon after that. She stayed for a few months and then went back to Kansas and got married to an old friend of ours. And she got very much into Native American practices and wore two braids. And I didn't get married for about 10 years. And you know, one braid is the Vedic style. So I remembered that Lady had predicted that years later. But, so then my parents were concerned. I wrote home, guys, I think I'll stay here for a while. I don't know how long I'm staying with these Hare Krishnas. And they were quite concerned. Their friends told them, you know, she's probably been brainwashed. And we think this is something like the Jonestown group. And actually, that was just right at the time when this horrible thing happened in America, that some cult members murdered themselves, committed suicide, like hundreds, right?
Yeah.
So it was really very close to that time. And so they came to England to check it out.
To check it out, or
to see if I was okay.
To steer you away, okay.
Yeah, well I don't know how seriously they took it, but they were advised that I should be deprogrammed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that it could be a serious problem, and I really needed to fix, you know, the situation. But when they arrived, I think they were happily surprised. They hadn't known really anything about it. They were able to see that, oh, this is not like, you know, some young charismatic teacher who started a cult. It's actually a very saintly gentleman who is guiding these people, and it's based on a very ancient, very bona fide spiritual tradition. They saw that I wasn't getting intoxicated. I was like celibate. I was eating healthy, and you know, so they felt better. And they saw that the people there were so happy. They were like, oh my God, what are they taking if they're not doing drugs? Because everybody was very joyful. So what else can I tell you?
Well, I mean, was that pretty much the reaction? They were just okay with it when they came to England and they went
yeah.
back to America?
I mean, they actually are basically very open-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to give me the benefit of the doubt. And when they saw that, yeah, well, you know, actually seems like not a bad situation. I'm sure it wasn't easy, but...
What about your siblings?
You know, was like a kind of raging fanatic when I got back to Kansas to visit them. I was I can't remember exactly how bad I was, but you know how it is when some people, when you get enthused about something and then you think that other people should do it too. And so, but I guess I, you know, they were all just like very, very open-minded as well. And they were like, hey, she wants to do this, let her do it. So
you're a Vaishnava. What would you say your general religious beliefs are? If somebody asked you, what do you believe, what would you tell them?
I would say that the goal of life is to uncover the pure love that is already there within the heart. Pure love of God, and that a very wonderful means for doing that is to chant the names of God, and the bhakti yoga process is really a lifestyle. It's, you know, as much as a person can they would organize their life in such a way that whatever they do, they would dedicate that to God. It's not so much about restricting yourself from so many things or you know, doing so many rituals, that can be part of it, but the essence is that whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you you know, think about, you try to have God at the center, and you try to devote your energy to God. To make your life a celebration of God. And Krishna is a name for God that means the most attractive, just like a magnet attracts other magnets. In that same way, God is attracting our souls. And so there are unlimited names for God, but this one is considered to be very, very sweet, and each name, you know, will have a different effect that we chant, and according to, you know, the sincerity or the intention that we have when we call out somebody's name, that brings a different effect. Like if for instance, my father, some people called him Dr. Burgess, and he would answer, yes, can I help you? And other people called him Arthur, and he would say, hey, what's going on? And other people would call him Art, and he'd be like, yo. However they said that back in the 60s. And there were some people that called him Daddy. And so he would answer them differently. He'd be like, yeah? Yes, honey? And there was somebody who called him Sweetie Pie. And when he heard that name, it like pulled on his heartstrings. And he would answer more like, uh-huh. And so when we, you know, the name God means something like great, isn't it? Or good, very good. So God is great and God is very good, but the more intimate names are attractive to God. It's like brings out a special kind of flavor of sweetness. And so and so when we call out a very sweet name with a very sweet intention, like, I love you, I just want to serve you, somehow or other, let me please you. When God hears that we're saying like that, then it really, we experience a lot of pleasure. And the soul is pleasure seeking. It's not like we can ever give that up. We want to experience bliss and pleasure and happiness. So the problem is we're just getting like little drops of that in the material world where we live now. We're wanting an ocean of happiness, but we're getting like one drop. And it's temporary. We get it and then it's gone. Or, you know, so we spend time hankering to have that happiness, and then while we have it, we're in anxiety thinking, oh my God, what if it's taken away? What if I lose it? What if they leave me? What if my car breaks? What if I lose my job? What if? And then we do lose it. Like inevitably, either, you know, our dear one leaves us or dies, or you know, we get old and sick and we do lose our job, or we die. So this is like haunting. People are being haunted by this feeling that this doesn't feel right, that I should have to die. I don't feel like I should have to suffer illness, and it just doesn't seem right. Because actually our real identity is that we are eternal. We're eternal spiritual beings, and we have this eternal relationship with God. So if we're looking the other way, we're just not getting the full ocean of bliss that we could be experiencing. And it's possible to get back to that, to, you know, even in this lifetime, to experience that kind of taste that we're hankering for. It's like we're thirsty. Our soul is thirsty. And we won't really, really be satisfied until we get to quench our thirst. So yeah, my experience has been that this chanting actually is a very effective means for helping to awaken that. And it's something that can be done by any, you know, a person of any religion, any culture. You know, it doesn't matter how you dress, it doesn't matter what your lifestyle is like. To a huge extent, it helps if you drop certain anchors that, you know, create more difficulty for you to move forward in spiritual life. Like if you're involved in doing violent things to other people, for instance, then it's kind of like an anchor that because you've hurt someone, you have to experience the reaction to that, the karma for that. And so then it's hard to sail on because you have to keep going back to, you know, to deal with that stuff that you've created from your past. So we try to be nonviolent and, you know, in action and speech and thought and so many ways. And it's a process. It's a long, long journey to actually, you know, develop these nice qualities that come with being a true, you know, a true servant of God. And it's not really about the externals. It's a personal journey, you know, for each person.
There are certain things, though, that you don't do, that you've taken vows against doing, like intoxicants. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you live your day-to-day life?
Yeah, so those are called the four regulative principles. No meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, and no illicit sex life. And sometimes they're also described as the regulative principles of freedom. And for that same reason that I was saying, that every action that we do is going to have a reaction. So these are things that can just kind of implicate us more in the complications of material living, you know. So you know, it may sound like a difficult situation if we're not used to thinking like that, but actually, you know, it's not that we have to give up everything and just sit down in the Himalayas. It's just kind of simplifying your life, kind of trying to, you know, eat vegetarian food, which is, you know, not difficult these days, to find, you know, a person to commit to, a partner to commit to, you know, if possible. It's helpful. It's a help. And, you know, rather than like going here and there constantly through your life, trying out this person and that person, and to you know, keep sober and not complicate your life with things like gambling. It's just you know, once you get used to it, you don't even think about it. It just makes the things easier, simplifies your life.
Tell us about yoga and how you got involved in yoga and what that does for your life, what that means for you.
Yeah, I was just always had a real natural attraction for hatha yoga from the time I was a teenager.
What's hatha yoga?
That just usually refers to the yoga asanas and breathing practices, the postures and breathing practices. And I just have always done that in my life, and then more recently in the last 20 years got more seriously educated about the technical part and began teaching, and I found that it's a nice segue to bhakti, to devotion. You know, it's a way that helps to kind of prepare you to go internally, to meditate. It's just like a natural way to help give up all kinds of dis-ease in your body, in your mind. Emotionally, it works in a very unique way to allow any energy that might have gotten stuck in your subtle body to just move on through, so that you can just be more light and free to have a peaceful mind. It works very well.
What about your business? How did you get involved teaching yoga to students?
Well, it just kind of organically evolved. I, like I said, was practicing myself, and at one point a sister of mine asked if I would teach a class to some teenage girls and their moms to help them with their self-confidence issues, and they just felt like it helped so much that I thought, yeah, actually, why isn't everybody doing this? It feels so good. Everybody should feel this good. And so, yeah, like in about 85 or something, I started teaching some classes and just kept it up. And then when the kids got a little older, I increased. And when we moved out to the country, I was fortunate to have a space out there to use as a yoga studio so that we could have classes in a really peaceful atmosphere. And then I somehow I just got enthused about training yoga teachers so that we could also go a little more deeply into the philosophy. We study the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which are mostly about the nature of the mind, how to help the mind become more peaceful. And also we do some Bhagavad Gita. We try to include some elements of bhakti, just in a very non-sectarian way, you know, how everybody can bring out the feelings of love in the heart while they do the yoga postures and also do a little chanting. And so it's good fun.
And you're married and you have children and they're all devotees too?
I'm married and I have three sons. And our kids really, we didn't insist that they do the practices with us when they were young. We more or less just, try to be an example ourselves, that an honest example, like that we weren't saying that we were perfect at it, but we just try to accept ourselves as we are and be, they could see that we were happy with the spiritual practice that we were doing. And so, you know, they, I think, are still not doing a lot of the practices, but they I think have benefited by having learned about some of the principles of how karma works, how reincarnation works, some of the, you know, understanding about who God is, but they're also very open-minded, you know, they try to see that, you know, in a very all-inclusive way, I think, that everybody's, you know, on a journey and is more or less just where they ought to be on that journey at that time and you know, doing their best to become the best person that they can be. And yeah, we're good kids.
You raised your kids in Kansas, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mostly.
Mostly. Did you ever feel like there were any challenges to being a Vaishnava in Kansas and raising your child and being a part of what's typically considered a stigmatized religion?
I guess I just expected that it would be not so much hard for me, but harder for other people to understand what I was up to. Because having grown up here, I knew that it's just weird, you know, some of the external parts anyway. I chose to just dress in kind of regular Kansas clothing most of the time when we do our devotional practices in the mornings or on the weekends. Then I will wear traditional Indian sari or Punjabi suits. But I just wanted people to feel comfortable that I'm just a regular person, and if they, you know, I didn't want people to be frightened of me.
Why do you think that there is such a that people have such a negative view about Vaishnavism, specifically is represented by the Hare Krishna movement in America, in Kansas even?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think people have such a negative view towards your religious faith?
I think that pretty much all over America, probably the number one reason is that when in the early days, the methods of book distribution were really fanatical, and the people, the devotees, going into airports and in the cities, just accosting people and trying somehow or other to get them to take books. It just rubbed people up the wrong way, and it caused a lot of problems later on. They were, they had good intentions, and they just were feeling like if people would just read something about this, then they'll appreciate it. But many people are not there, and I think that our guru Srila Prabhupada, he really wanted people to be able to read his books, but I'm sure that he would hope that they would receive them in a way that was very gentlemanly or gentlewomanly. So and also just the practice, one of the practices is to dance and chant through the streets with loud musical instruments. So where do you see that in Kansas, unless it's, or anywhere? It's a tradition that in India they wouldn't think was so unusual. But people just think they're aliens, so it's really hard to relate to that, probably. But, gradually, I think that that people are becoming, through our modern technology maybe, and so many reasons, people are becoming acquainted with other cultures and other ways, and becoming more open to many different ways. And the devotees are calming down a little bit, and so.
There's someone at the door.
Oh.
Like, pause this. Oh. Okay. The last question I was going to ask you is that whenever I am in an interview, I always ask the person I'm interviewing one question, which is, what do you think of when you think of God? Who do you think of when you think of God?
I think of Radha and Krishna as the original form of the original personality of God, in the form of the original male and original female, original energy and the energetic. The source of all beauty, the source of all sweetness, strength, and our ever well wisher.
Well, thank you very much for taking part in the interview.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.